Look up there in the sky. It's a bird, a plane. It's Handsome Boys Comics Hour.
Those boys are so handsome.
One writer.
One artist.
It's one weekly discussion of comics, internet culture. I'm your host, Robbie Dorman, literature geek and writer.
And I'm your other host, Eric Z. Goodnight, professional artist and illustration nerd.
And we are the Heads of Boys Comics Hour. Your home for news, reviews, slightly antagonistic banter, and much, much more.
And one of these days, we're going to get through that without cracking up.
One of these days.
One of these days. It's
pam, bow, straight to the moon.
Just bang, zoom. I want to say.
Spousal abuse isn't funny, Eric.
You're the one that brought it up.
What are you talking about?
That's right. You're a crazy person.
How's it going, Eric? How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing it up. Doing it up large.
Large, you say?
Well, how would you prefer I do it up?
Large is good.
I have two speeds, and one of them's large.
I have two speeds, slow and slower.
That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, man.
We're chillaxing. This is the jazzy Handsome Boys Comics Hour. After dark.
I feel so classy.
Yeah.
After dark.
After dark.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But, Handsomeites, we have Dragon Ball for you later on.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Some more manga.
Yeah, manga.
Hitting up some manga. We got all the comic books. We got an extra comic book this week.
I know. It's one more than usual.
One more than usual, so I know you should be excited about that. But first of all, we are going to jump in to checking in. Checking in is the segment where Eric and I talk about what we've been up to during the week and talk about it. Generally nerdy things. Eric, what have you been up to this week?
It's always got to be me, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Always got to. No,
it's not always,
I've,
but sometimes.
I've not had time to do a whole heck of a lot.
I hear you.
I did do one thing that's been very fun, and your fiance actually turned me on to it.
What would that be?
It's called geocaching.
Oh yeah, that's fun.
It is. It's crazy fun, and although it does seem like people in South Tampa is like let me hide something the size of a matchbox in a bunch of mud. Like that's how you cache around here.
Some people are a little extreme about how they hide things. Like you know exactly where it is, but you can't find it.
It's tough. But I guess I should sort of set it up considering I don't have to explain to you what geocaching is.
Hey, but, Eric, what's geocaching?
Oh, it's a good thing you asked, Robbie. Geocaching, I'm using, what is it, geocache.com or whatever that app is, but it's just basically like a weird community of people. They just hide things in public places and give you the coordinates, and you use your GPS or your phone or whatever to track down to it. You search around and there's just like hidden shit everywhere. It's fascinating. It's like this whole like hidden world of stuff. That's kind of the aspect that I like about it. I think related to this, people that geocache, at least on this geocaching.com or .org. It's one of the main places that comes up when you search for geocaching. At least on this site, they refer to people that don't know what geocaching is as muggles. And I think that's kind of how I relate to it, is it's sort of this hidden world beneath the world.
It is geocaching.com.
Yes. There you go. Thank you for doing my homework for me.
I use the same site and I use that same app. It's a solid app.
It's probably I don't know. I struggle a lot with the GPS on my phone, and I'm wondering what you like. you and your fiance, you're both iPhone people for whatever odd reason. But I think that I want to say the GPS is better in the iPhone.
I don't know. I've never had real, I mean, sometimes it's always, GPS is always kind of hit and miss,
yeah.
I think, on any, most mobile devices, honestly, but.
Well, it gets me 9/10 of the way there every time. It'll just drop out. Like, I'll go to they're almost always seem to be hidden in parks and things.
Yeah.
And even on that level, I have found like 3 parks that are in my neighborhood that I can like walk or ride my bike to that I had no idea existed. That's part of the beauty of the whole thing.
Oh yeah, it's making you go out and find stuff.
You're just discovering your neighborhood in a way that you would never see it, you know, otherwise. It's really great for that. But you'll always get to the spot where you think the cache is, and the hint may or may not be worth it at all, you know, and I don't know. The last one I found was really incredibly frustrating. Because the guy said it was in a peanut jar, and it wasn't. It was in a pill jar.
Right.
And he didn't leave a hint either. And it was in like a swamp in the mud.
Those hints are spotty.
They're meant to make you mad. The first one that I went on my lunch break. It was real close to work, so I went up and it said it's supposed to be a real easy find. It's right there. And the hint was stop and look around. I'm like, that's the worst hint ever. Until I noticed that there were stop signs around. And I'm like, well, it's hidden in that stop sign. I go up to the stop sign, full of bees.
Jesus.
So I did not succeed on my first geocache, but I've had a couple others that have been more successful. Yeah. So far, I've got about a 40% success rate.
I think I would say 50% is probably, if you get 50, you're like, that's a good day.
Really, I'm at 60%, but that stop sign was full of bees. I'm not, I don't care.
Did you find anything interesting? Like anything in those little packages?
Not really. I mean, most of them were like little, just the logs. One of them was like an ammo crate. And it had like some squirt guns and like an invisible ink pen and a bunch of little kids' toys, which I wasn't going to take any of them, and I wasn't going to make no big thing of it.
That's kind of the transaction. Like that's the usual, like that's basically what the money is toys. Cause those are the only things that can really like fit, like keychains and like little figures are like the only things that will generally fit in those little tiny.
Yeah.
So that's like we bought. When we first started, we went to a dollar store and bought like a little package of Army Men, mm-hmm. a package of like dinosaurs. And we were, you know, put a dinosaur in and pull out a little tiny thing and, you know, just to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah. You have yourself some geocaching treasure, but geocaching's rad.
It is. I agree. If you guys don't, listeners haven't tried it before, it's a lot of fun. It's a good like group activity. It's like basically just a giant scavenger hunt, and mm-hmm. almost everyone now has the ability to use their phones.
Yeah, so. you don't need a separate GPS. Although I would imagine it would probably be more accurate in those in the nitty gritty.
Probably,
but I mean, you really it'll get you mostly there, and you can usually figure it out. And depending on if there's bees or some asshole threw the cache into the mud, it's usually. There are other circumstances other than the GPS that are going to screw you up. So I assume you sat in a broom closet just blanking yourself.
Well, no, that'd be more fun than what I generally do during the week. I sat in a cubicle at work.
And wanked yourself? That's weird.
I did not do that. I sat quietly and listened to podcasts.
I'm glad that you're not wanking yourself at work. That's probably good.
I have two podcasts I want to check in with.
Sweet.
Particularly useful for people who enjoy RPGs.
Okay.
Meaning tabletop RPGs like Dungeons and Dragons, not Mass Effect or Skyrim. Although those are good too. But this is a pair of podcasts. One is a spinoff of the other. The first one is called One Shot. And it is basically James D'Amato. He is a guy who's DMing for like a decade now. he basically takes like kind of has he has like a core group of people. He's like in Chicago, he's really heavy in the improv scene, so he gets a lot of comedians and you know people do improv a lot and sketch comedy, and basically have them do like capsule adventures in different RPG systems, and it is usually they're really funny people, so they generally you know they're really good at playing their characters and making you know they it. Inevitably create funny situations, but it's also for people who are into RPGs and do not have the time to test out the 10 million different systems that are out there. It kind of gives you like a little encapsulated experience in how they play.
That's really neat.
Yeah, and there's two I'd like to mention that I think were a lot of, that were really interesting. One is called Dungeon World. I've actually purchased the PDF online since listening to this episode, and it's basically D&D without like all the combat.
It's all kind of the like they, all the heavy combat or no yeah, combat it, at all.
No, there's combat. It just makes it
it's really it's simpler. Really stripped down and simplified.
No initiative. Everyone, you just kind of when you think of to do something, you just say it, and then the DM will. It puts a lot of onus on the DM to craft a story about what the players want to do. So that is it, like, cause D&D, you just rely on the rules of this, the combat system where you just go, okay, well this person goes next and they can do what they want with their amount of actions. In this, you can say, well, there's two trolls. I want to sneak around the back of the troll and try and stab him. And there's a lot less kind of stats and math you have to do. It's basically everything, almost everything in the game is just 2d6 rolls plus a number. And what you get is if you succeed but have a compromise, or if you fail. And then the DM just kind of reacts and tells a story around it. But it's the same kind of universe as D&D. I've only barely gotten into the rule book, but it's interesting. I don't know if we'll ever... Because I like the tactical combat, because Eric and I are in a D&D game together, and the only thing I don't like about the tactical combat is that it takes so long.
Yeah, you are very vocal, and by that I mean you whine all the time.
Well, it takes forever.
It does take forever. It's D&D. It's just what it is.
I know, but
I think that simplifying it, stripping it down, probably a good thing, because I think if you were going to say anything bad about D&D, it is that, you know, 3 hours of your life go by, and you fight two groups of dudes.
Yes. Hey, look, it took 15 minutes of game time and a million hours of real life time.
Oh, yeah. Like, 15 minutes in D&D is like 9 sessions.
Yeah. The other one I want to touch on is, like, it's designed almost for encapsulated adventures, so I think we could do it with a group of friends. Mm-hmm. It'd just be one time thing and it'd be fun. And then we don't want to have to worry about it. And it's called Everyone is John.
Uh-huh.
Where every different player is basically John is a guy with multiple personality. Dissociative identity disorder, as it's called now.
I think that's the correct. If you want to be correct,
technically is the best kind of correct. But every player is a different insane personality in John's head, and they're basically bidding for control of his body, trying to achieve their own crazy goals.
Wow,
and it. One shot, they basically just made it. They put a like a H.P. Lovecraft kind of theme on it, where this guy went crazy from reading the Necronomicon, and so he had three different personalities trying to like. They're basically like you have a set number of willpower that you bid, and you can spend it to help with your dice rolls. But you have goals to try and get more points, and they're all like really like locking doors. One dude's thing: every time he locked a door, he got a point. Another dude's, every time he shoves something up his butt, you got a point.
Well, I mean.
Every time he lights a building on fire, 5 points. Every time he got high, like he would just stop in the middle, he would wrest control from another player and just start huffing gasoline.
Jesus Christ.
But it was insane and really funny. But there's, it's been going on for over a year now, so there's lots of different systems they touch on. The other podcast I want to talk is a spinoff of that one. It's just called Critical Success, also by James D'Amato. But this one is more about the theory of DMing and roleplay. And it's really just kind of almost educational about how to be a better role player or DM, and like how to just like how it works.
Mm.
It's very interesting, and the episodes are like 20 minutes long, 30 minutes long usually, and it's just kind of like they're not. It's not a regular show. He does it like once a month, if that. If you're into RPGs, definitely check out that, just because it teaches you about different types of players and how certain people want to play a certain way. And like, I think it's aimed mostly at DMs, but I think anybody who plays tabletop RPGs regularly can get something out of it. It's interesting. Yeah. Hey guys, we're going to be at Dragon Con next week.
I know. I'm stupidly excited.
Yeah. Short week, then fun.
Yeah. It's the way all weeks should be.
It really should. It'd be so much better.
Yeah.
But with that, I think we can close the door on checking in and then lock it for 1 point. We're going to jump over to weekly floppies now. The floppiest part of the week. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I know. It's a good thing I've been working out my legs.
Yeah, jumping. Lots of jumping.
Do some jumping.
Roll a dex check. Mm-hmm. Weekly floppies is the part of the show where Eric and I read the week's books and tell you to buy or do not buy them. And we're right. Sometimes.
Well, I know I always am.
Starting off in DC. We'll just move past that.
Whatever, Robbie. Whatever.
We're starting off with DC in Multiversity number one, much heralded, Grant Morrison written. Can't find a credits page. Their names are on the front of the book.
Well, I think you've said the only name that matters to
here it is.
Most of the people that are going to buy it.
As normal, the credits page is on page 19 of the comic book.
Well, there's...
right in the middle.
This is an extra normal comic book, so it's...
I guess that's fair enough. It is extra normal. Yeah. Written by Grant Morrison, Ivan Reese doing pencils, Joe Prado on inks, Ney Ruffino colors, Todd Klein on letters. This is a very Grant Morrison-y comic.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's meta, weird as fuck, makes so little sense.
It's, like, there's a, on Comics Alliance, someone wrote an annotated guide to every page. Like, it's a fucking term paper.
Yeah.
We have to have footnotes to understand who this character is and where they came from.
He's setting out to write the fucking Finnegan's Wake of comics, I think.
It's a lot of it is stuff continued from Final Crisis, which I have not read, and also continued from Infinite Crisis on Infinite Earths. Also, like, he's pulling from the multiverse, the DC's continued layering of reboots and unreboots, mm-hmm. and trying to basically create this idea of all these different universes and stuff happening between them and things breaking down and this awful monster called the Gentry, which is, I guess, rich white people taking over poor neighborhoods in the shape of, like, eldritch horrors. But there's lots of analogs to different heroes, and they are doing things.
Yes, very, very well said. Very well speaked at, my friend.
I honestly don't know how much of this can be enjoyed by an average comics reader.
I don't know what in the hell's going on in 90% of this book. I still did enjoy it on some level. I want to read that annotated term paper on it. I'm actually pretty fascinated by that.
Yeah, once you read it, it just clears up a lot of the weird things, but I don't know that a lot of the, I think some of it can be, I don't know, read into like make it bet like more than it is. Like the Hulk in one of these is just a big blue, literally a baby.
Yes.
He has a diaper on. And I don't really think there's any more to that than, hey, the character, the Hulk, I don't like it. I'm Grant Morrison. I don't like the Hulk.
Yeah. It kind of read like that.
Yeah. And there's like there's a Doctor Doom analog and a whole Fantastic Four analog. Mm-hmm. Major Comics instead of Marvel Comics.
You know, really ridiculous, but I mean, what is he going to do? What is he going to say?
It reminded me a lot of Alan Moore's Supreme, which I think that's another one of these types of stories.
Yes.
Kind of a meta-textual exploration of superheroes and what they mean and what they are. Because, I mean, some of this book is speaking directly to a reader. Like, there are captions that are saying, stop reading. And they're talking to us.
Yeah.
And
I thought they were talking to me. Oh my God! Hey, well, they're talking to you.
Just you.
I thought I was the only one. I am the only one.
I think so. It's only talking to you, Eric. Okay. Grant Morrison wrote this comic book explicitly for you to read,
and it's cursed.
It is a cursed comic book. Don't read this comic book. It's cursed.
My God.
I still like it well enough, but this is not for like the faint of heart. This is confusing. And there's a lot of him referencing lots of different things that, unless you've read all these comic books, it doesn't necessarily mean a whole bunch. You have to just kind of infer what you think it means.
Yeah.
I like the art. It's suitable, I would say, for what's happening. There's different artists on every single issue, so I think Grant Morrison is kind of crafting this story for next issue is Chris Sprouse, who is wonderful. But I think this works well enough for Captain Carrot, I think, is my favorite character.
He's pretty good, isn't he?
Yeah, I like Captain Carrot. Anytime you can introduce superhero bunny rabbits, I'm totally for it.
You're fur it. You ain't again it.
Precisely. I'm a buy.
Well, yeah. You should be buying this book. It's weird.
It is very weird.
It is incredibly fucking weird.
It's very weird. I'm for DC publishing a very strange comic book.
Yes.
Written by Grant Morrison.
It's kind of a throwback to, what was that Wile E. Coyote character in Animal Man?
Yeah, well, there's, in the annotated thing they talk about, there's some references to his original Animal Man run.
It feels like some of the weirdest bits of that.
Did you catch Dino Cop?
Oh, God. Yeah, that's the Savage Dragon like crazy.
Yeah, it is. And there's also when he says Spore, that's apparently supposed to refer to Spawn, which I don't think there's no Spawn analog on panel, but
yeah.
That's what he's referring to. There's also like a little chibi Steel and Wonder Woman.
I know. It was adorable. Totes adorbs.
Yeah. But, you know, Aquawoman, I guess, is Queen of Atlantis. There's a metal hawk guy.
Mm-hmm.
Hawk.
That's a deep cut.
Yeah, it is. But, yeah. We're double buy. It's a weird-ass comic. But yeah. It's,
pay for it with your weirdest money.
But it's fun. It's a fun, weird-ass comic. It's Grant Morrison. It's next up in DC is Teen Titans number 2, written by Will Pfeiffer, art by Kenneth Rocafort, Dan Brown. Doing colors, John J. Hill on letters. We had read issue 1. We were mostly for it with some caveats. I think that was the general consensus. I think this one is much better than that first issue.
I don't know that I exactly think that it's much better. I kind of feel the same about it, that it's this is DC taking steps in the right direction, and it is still a little on the rough side. It's not terrible. I just think that a lot of these characters and a lot of the storytelling is still a little clumsy, but it's the right direction. They're not as lost in the woods on this one as they are on a lot of their older books that we have talked so much shit about.
And Beast Boy turns into Grumpy Cat.
Dude, I know that's the only thing you care about.
It certainly is a pro. But
I really get tired of the we can't use the real name thing.
Well,
Chirper and what do they say? Angry Cat or what do they call it?
I forget what it is.
They won't even use Grumpy Cat.
Well,
they won't even say Grumpy Cat.
To be fair, Grumpy Cat is pretty, like, the owners of Grumpy Cat are pretty serious about their licensing. They license everything. So I don't know if they'd sue DC Comics about them using it, but they probably just didn't want to have to go through the process of trying to okay it with them. I don't know. It's a safe cat. But, this is mostly following basically Bunker and Beast Boy with a brief little, side story with these female gangs dressing up as Wonder Girl, like on roller skates and with
they're just derby girls.
They're beating the shit out of like muggers, and I don't know, this book has a lot less kind of, there's not, the first issue really was about these terrorists and them on the school bus and them fighting. This is more following each characters individually, kind of introducing a lot of side stories. And but I liked it more mainly, I guess, it because it explores the characters a little bit more and explores kind of the, I really like they actually show the dude who got, we mentioned that in that first issue about that dude that got thrown into a building and almost died. And they actually talk about him in the hospital and how they actually saved his life because the bomb didn't go off and blah, blah, blah. But I think it was interesting that they actually followed up on that. And I'm kind of interested in this female character, even though her name is Algorithm, this robot lady who's made out of nano machines, apparently. I'm a bi.
Yeah. I'm bi-ish. It's a good book. I want it to be a good book. You gotta support some DC book, I guess. It should be this one. It should not be Robin Rises Omega.
We are a double bi on Teen Titans number 2. Eric is a little weaker on his than on mine. Than mine is.
Yeah.
But that's still a double bi. It's still there.
It is.
We're moving on to Marvel. We got 3 Marvel books this week. I think we generally just, basically every time Miss Marvel comes out, I throw it on the list regardless of what else is, because we're both reading it anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to skip Miss Marvel.
Yeah. We're going to start off with Storm number 2. I know Eric was very excited about Storm number 1, so I made sure to put this on the list.
This is, this book is so good.
Written by Craig Pak, art by Victor Ibanez, colors by Ruth Redmond, letters by Cord Pettit. Yeah, this is, like Eric said, a very good comic book.
It's excellent.
It's a lot of fun. We get a lot of like Storm and Wolverine like flirting with each other. It's pretty.
They're doing more than flirting with each other.
Okay, kissing each other, making out.
They're making out in public.
Okay, that's true. They're making out in public. I think it's like Friends, basically, X-Men is, where every female character and every male character eventually have to hook up that are not related.
Yes.
It's just, there have been many, I mean, several times in history where Storm and Wolverine have been like, they've had a thing for a bit. But this is mainly, I mean, the story of this is her going like into the tunnels trying to find these runaways and with Callisto, who is, they've had a history with the Morlocks and all that. This story goes a different way, and I think that's good. It's a little, you get a little bit of a little twist, you know. And it reflects back on Storm's own childhood as like an orphan runaway. The art's really nice.
I love the way this book is drawn. It's I guess hard for me to explain, but they just have a real sense of objects in space, and they're drawn at such interesting angles. And it's got really nice brushwork too. Everything really complements each other. Really well. The colors flesh out the forms and really add exactly what the colors should add. It doesn't get in the way too much. It's minimal and flat, but still manages to warm it up. And just, I don't know, it's gorgeous. I adore the art team on this book.
And I really, the scenes in the sewers.
Oh, man.
The darkness contrasted with her lightning.
Mm-hmm.
It's really wonderful, the shadows and the way they play with the light.
It's terribly effective.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good things.
I really like the ending image of Storm towering over Logan. Like, Logan is short.
He's a little shorty.
He should be shorter than Storm, and a lot of the times they obfuscate his height, and they do not try and hide it at any point in this book. They like, you know, Logan's a short dude. It's fine. That's who he is. This is a great book. You guys should be buying this. This is excellent.
Yes. This is. God, it's so good.
Yeah.
I hope it runs for a really long time. I'm stupidly excited about it.
So that's a double buy. You guys couldn't figure that out. Storm number 2, double buy. Definitely get it. Another book you should definitely be buying if you're not already. Miss Marvel number 7. I don't think we have to hide our enthusiasm. Written by G. Willow Wilson, art by Jacob Wyatt, Ian Herring in colors, Joe Harrimagna on letters. This is following Kamala and, again, Logan in their adventures in the sewer fighting. More another sewer adventure. Fighting the... what is it?
That's where all the action is. It's in the pooper nowadays.
Mega Gator. Fighting a Mega Gator. And like,
I mean, yes, naturally. They're going to fight Sharknado next month.
Yeah, escaping... the inventor's kind of labyrinth he's built under the sewer, but this is really good. I really like this a lot.
It's almost ridiculous to even say that.
I know the
book is delightful.
It's so wonderful. Like the moments of Wolverine talking about, he's like, you know, he's the grizzled old superhero and she's very fresh to all this. And mm-hmm. he's like giving her like a very short kind of breakdown. The thing about that one page where they're climbing up through the sewer systems, that is, and they're, you know, it reads from bottom left to top right.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's the only nitpicking I'd say, that it takes a bit to realize how you're
it's really
to
yeah. I think I applaud them for trying something a little bit avant-garde, but it doesn't really make sense. I mean, this is so dissembled that it borderlines needs like the bubbles to be numbered, like Winsor McKay or something. Like, it makes zero sense.
But the page itself is very very nice.
Oh, yeah.
And I like the little, like they do like the little Simpsons gag where they throw shit and like in the dirt, like there's a box of locusts and there's a dinosaur skeleton and a giant sword. There's a huge sword buried in the dirt. And there's a Mario cube. I don't know if you noticed that, Eric.
I did not.
A box with question marks. Little Mario.
I do see that.
Yeah. Those little touches. The
the Konami code's written on the wall as well.
Yeah, it is. A lot of little touches of character really give it, you know, some flavor to the environment. And I mean, this is, you know, even in the recap, they talk about Kamala's like, I don't know, I can't. She uses the word squee. You know, she's hanging out with Wolverine. She's a super fan, and now.
Yeah, of course she's going to say squee.
Yeah, of course she is. And the last page reveal, Eric. Kamala is going to get to partner up with Lockjaw.
Yep.
That's...
Well, that was kind of the sort of reveal through this, that she's more than likely an inhuman. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense given all this.
Exactly. And I'm Kamala and Lockjaw, I can get behind that. That is a team up I can get behind. This, yeah, the art is really nice. It's not Adrian Alfana. I know Eric is, but
it is not, but it is enjoyable for its own right, and it works for the book, and it's got that it still gives me the warm fuzzies. I love Kamala.
Yeah, this is a great book. You guys, go get it. This is another book this should be running forever. Kamala, hopefully, is a character that lasts in the Marvel Universe, doesn't fade.
So, Robbie,
mm-hmm.
I've noticed a disturbing trend.
What is this? We're liking all these comics?
Well, no, that's the opposite of disturbing. Okay. That means there's actually good comics. No.
Yes, what?
No, we're liking three books that are about minorities. Two of them are about women, minority women. I think this means that we hate white men.
Oh, well, I do hate white men.
Okay.
I'll make that clear. I didn't want anyone to be confused.
Okay.
White men are awful. They're disgusting. down with the patriarchy.
Whoa there.
Yeah.
Don't go getting your knickers in a twist.
I know. Our last Marvel book of the week is another New Avengers book. New Avengers number 23. They're pumping these out.
They're coming out every 23 minutes.
This is written by Jonathan Hickman, art by our buddy Kev Walker, colors by Frank Martin, letters by Joe Caravaggio. This picks up almost directly after the events of the last issue. And it kind of just, most of it is just following these dudes around, kind of dealing with their pain of, you know, dealing with these awful. I like this book, and I think the art is a lot better than that last issue. Which
It's not even fair to compare it.
I think there's no fight scenes in this, and I think that's seems to do it better with the still kind of contemplative scenes. His kind of expressions and the emotions work better, I guess. It certainly made me not feel like it was ridiculous like I did in some of those pages of the last one. We see them all kind of dealing with pain, and then they're all together waiting for the next incursion when nothing happens, and they're wondering why. But then Black Bolt asks, where's Namor? What happened with him?
I think that's the right question to ask.
Yeah, hey. His sign language is the best. Where's Namor is a tree. He does three fingers like the trident. Where's Namor? And spoiler alert for the last page of this is, semi-last page. Namor has assembled his own kind of crowd of
his own Illuminati.
Yeah, the Cabal, the return of the Cabal after Dark Reign with Maximus, Thanos, and a bunch of a couple of his lieutenants, plus Black Swan or White Swan. What was her name? Black Swan.
Black Swan.
Black Swan. I want to say she has white skin and black clothes.
She could be either one.
So he's assembled all these baddies to basically, you know, we have to stop.
She is Black Swan.
Okay. Well, they're Eric Fact Checker. Basically, gonna do the job that these good guys found themselves the inability to do. Should be interesting. I like this book. It's just the only problem with it I have is we just read Storm, number two, and it has Storm and Beast in it. And this has Storm and Beast in it, and it is Beast. And Beast is the bigger exception here, that the Beast in this is obviously very conflicted and troubled. The Beast in Storm is, like, very happy-go-lucky and kind of like the unwilling, kind of the sidekick to Storm. Like, he's basically Oracle. He kind of he sits around and works on the computers for her.
And I kind of don't like Beast in Storm. I don't like the way he's written terribly. That's my one caveat about Storm. The rest of it's beautiful, but I don't like the way he's done in that.
I'm fine with it. I just don't. That's the, I guess, the bigger the issue with having such everything, especially in a book like New Avengers, where like every character is in it, every big character is in it. It's continuities. You just don't think about it. That's kind of what you have to do.
Yeah.
But I'm a buy. The art in this is a definite improvement. I think it works better without all those fight scenes.
The last book was a failure. This one succeeds in pretty much every way the last one failed. And I am stunned that this is the same artist.
Yeah.
I can barely believe it. The last one looked like an amateur. He must have been working to rush through it. And that's the only thing I can see is that he was just bullshitting his way through it. He had like zero time. Because this does not even look like the same person at all.
Yeah, but much improved. The storytelling is still great. New Avengers number 23, I'm a buy.
Total buy.
Totes, double buy.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, but not leastly, we are going to The Fade Out, number one. It's our indie book of the week. Ed Brubaker's and Sean Phillips' debut as exclusive Image creators. They signed both of them signed 5-year deals. They just finished Vital, and they already are pumping out Fade Out number one. This is kind of it's Brubaker and Sean Phillips. They do noir stories, and this is like a Hollywood noir murder mystery, basically.
It immediately makes me think of Satellite Sam.
It is similar to Satellite Sam in a lot of ways, which is also kind of a Hollywood mystery murder noir thing, even though that takes place in New York, but you know, show business, etc. This reminds me more of like LA Confidential and all those, which I think that's Brubaker's wheelhouse, is stories like this. I mean, he's noir stories and crime and real life Hollywood mystery and all that stuff. What do you think about this, Eric?
I enjoyed it specifically because we read Satellite Sam for this podcast back when.
Yeah.
Did you say who that was by? It's a Fraction, isn't it?
Fraction and Howard Chaykin.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the art. I did not really care for the writing, but I only got one issue deep into it. It just sort of didn't work for me. For some reason, this feels a lot more comfy. This story works for me a lot better. I don't know. I fall into it a lot easier. It feels a lot more natural. There was just something about Fraction's writing of that issue that was a little bit messy. This, you, even without this, the setup page,
mm-hmm.
you don't need that to understand sort of the archetypes of these characters and what's going on. It feels like it's starting out straightforward, but I feel like it's gonna have some twists along the way. I mean, I don't even particularly need to compare it to Satellite Sam because it stands on on its own in this genre. It's very good.
No, yeah,
I enjoy it a lot. I don't know whoever this artist is. He's drawing the hell out of this woman with the glasses.
Sean Phillips has worked. I mean, he's worked with Brubaker for a long time now. As soon as Fatale, the last trade of Fatale comes out, we should do that for book club. Because have you read any of that yet?
I have not.
It's the same team that has more horror. It's kind of like this, but with horror, like Lovecraftian horror.
The only Brubaker that we've read so far. What was it? Winter Soldier? What was it we did?
Yeah, Winter Soldier.
Yeah. And I see the similarities, the stylistic similarities in the writing. It makes sense that he wrote those stories. But this is enjoyable on a lot of levels. It works really well, and I think this would be a good one to follow.
Yeah. This is a something you would expect from this team. It's great. It's good. You should anything with these two guys working together is almost guaranteed to be good, if not great. It's solid. So definitely a buy. Fade out number one.
No, absolutely. Buy.
Double buy. What else? I read both two Warren Ellis books that came out this week. Both Trees number four and the second Supreme Blue Rose book came out.
I would say
they both are kind of answer a little bit of your complaints about nothing happening. So there's a little bit of tension, especially in Supreme Blue Rose, that there's all kinds of crazy crap happens in that. Trees 4, though, it's a little bit of escalation towards what will be the fifth issue, I presume. Elektra 5, also great. I loving Elektra book. The art is so beautiful, and they're really kind of giving carving out a little niche for that character. That, she kind of can sometimes blend into the background with all the other kind of femme fatale characters that are in the Marvel universe. This is kind of giving her a little unique spot. Mm-hmm. I think it's time for Weekly Floppies to be over. I think we can close the door and lock it on Weekly Floppies. Get 1 point.
If you say so, you'll have to explain things to me.
We're going to jump out of Weekly Floppies and over to Nerd Boy Book Club. Nerd Boy Book Club is a segment of the show where Eric and I will assign, if you so to speak, a longer collected work, and I will read it and discuss it on the show. This week we are doing Dragon Ball, the original, volumes 1-6 by Akira Toriyama. No, none of that Z nonsense.
Mm-hmm. This is the first Dragon Ball stories that he told. As much as I love Dragon Ball Z, it's just sort of one of those things that I'm not going to waste a lot of energy defending it on an artistic level, at least in terms of the writing. But I full on love Akira Toriyama, and this is I think one of the best things he ever did. I just adore it, and I'm very excited to talk about it.
How long did this go on? The original Dragon Ball?
I really don't know. I want to say that the first one's, 1981, 1983, somewhere in that range they came out. I'm looking. Okay, apparently it came out in 1984. I thought it started earlier than
42 volumes total.
Yeah.
So,
well, that counts Dragon Ball Z, I want to say.
Does it?
Yeah, because that's the way it was. It was just one continuous thing. that just kept running and running and running for 42 volumes. I want to say that it's not 42 volumes of Dragon Ball and then a million volumes of Dragon Ball Z. In Japan, it's all one thing.
Ah,
but the cartoon was launched after Dragon Ball was over. The cartoon was launched as Dragon Ball Z, and keeping with that, they relaunched it here and they segregate the two, because Dragon Ball is more of like a young person's manga. Dragon Ball is like teenagers, and I think it kind of worked a little bit like Harry Potter, that it just sort of ran for so long that it matured with its audience. You know, that first book, it's for kids, and then by the last book, it's a lot darker. Although it sort of didn't work that way. It did in theory for a while, but it ran for so much longer that it, you know, didn't exactly work out that way by the...
God, I'm looking at the Wikipedia of this, and it's so confusing. Okay.
That's a good enough place to start.
Huh? I was like, yeah, I'm like trying to figure out where the separation of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, and then it just broils into that should, stuff you were mentioning with the animation and the...
Yeah, there's a break period after one of the Tenkaichi Budokai tournaments. You know, it's after the second Piccolo is introduced, Piccolo the Younger is introduced as a bad guy, and it's right before Goku's brother comes back. Goku's brother Raditz comes to Earth. That's where all that business starts. That's where Z begins, and it's sort of a shift in the story. It starts to be about, you know, outer space and, you know, more about all the shit that you think of Dragon Ball, of people flying around and screaming, and it's a little bit different up to that point, particularly these first six trades and a couple more after that, is it's more of a simple little adventure comic, and that's kind of what's so great about it. It's just sort of fun, silly stuff that Akira Toriyama likes to draw, and stories that don't take themselves too seriously, and it's just a lot of fun. I'm interested to hear what you think about it.
I do have a bone of contention about what you said about this reading quickly.
Well, I did not just say that. I did say it earlier. How long did you slog through it?
Well, it's not that four, five, and six went very quickly.
Yes.
It was 1, 2, and 3 is much denser. Yeah. It felt like reading bone.
I noticed that going through that, but it's certainly nowhere near as long as Bone.
No, it's not.
This is like, I think that what we just read, these six volumes, that's maybe a third of Bone.
No, and Bone keeps up that density almost from throughout the whole book. This is, I mean, right up until they get to that tournament. It's pretty dense, but then they just start having gigantic fight scenes, and, you know, you just look at the fight scene and you go, oh, that looks cool. And then you go to the next page. You don't have to like read, you know, 100 words.
Well, I think that's where the most of the exposition is. It's where a lot of the character work is. From then, it's just silly adventures.
Yes.
So it does get a lot lighter. I did find that I was having a harder time reading the first three trades, particularly because the thing about these six in particular, it might depart a little bit later, is for the cartoon, they pretty much decided they weren't going to do any storyboarding at all. They just used the panels. They basically recreated the panels exactly for the cartoon. And that's what's so weird looking at this, is it's like, I'll see a drawing in here. I'm like, oh, he drew that for this comic. It looks exactly like that. It's kind of strange to see it. Like it's so true to it, to the point of, you know, literally lifting panels and putting them directly on screen. It's more like an animated storybook.
Yeah. I watched very little of Dragon Ball Z. So I guess I only know, you know, what you like the general nerd public knows about Dragon Ball Z, which is, you know, all that crazy, you know, episodes, that entire episode is combat, you know, and people like continually, you know, increasing their power levels and all that. So I'm, this is kind of fresh. I mean, I don't know what I was expecting, honestly. And it really is kind of like you were describing an adventure comic. And that really at its core is what it is. I compared it to Bone because it kind of is like, it's a lot like Bone.
I can see the comparison because it's, I think the story and art, it works together in sort of the same way. And one of the main things certainly that I like about both of them is the art aspect. I mean, Toriyama is just a master cartoonist.
I think the other thing that really, I think the two things immediately struck me. One good and one kind of,
You cannot like this. I'm not.
No, no. I generally did like it. I think the clashing of very, like, I don't know if this is inherently kind of a Japanese, culturally Japanese idea, but the clashing of, like, very kind of simple culture, like people living in, you know, huts and, you know, living simply without electricity or anything like that, eating food from the forest. Like, Goku, when we first find him, is living by himself with a Dragon Ball that he considers his grandpa. And he really doesn't know anything about, like, modern so-called light, like electricity or cars, that he encounters Bulma. And she has, like, little capsules that can grow into motorcycles or cars and airplanes. And we see that further on. They eventually get to a major city, which is, it's everything, all this is all commonplace. And it's super high-tech advanced, much further advanced than we are. And that was the one thing that really struck me, is the fact that there's all this stuff in it. Like, they have these kind of fighting tournaments, which are, you don't really characterize with a modern society, so to speak. Technologically advanced society, at least. And yet at the same time, they have like super advanced motorcycles and like hovercraft and you know, all that stuff. And it's, that was the thing that really stood out to me, is the fact that, like, you get these kind of, he brings in a lot of disparate influences and puts them all together and also reminds me kind of the another adventure book we've read in the podcast, Scrooge, Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah.
Where there's adventures in that where he's like mining, like old timey mining.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, you know, scenes where it's much more advanced and where, you know, it's more modern, as we would say. And this is, it kind of broaches it. It doesn't try and limit itself to one, I guess, time period. It just says, oh, this is a different area. This area is much more. And Goku is kind of this ignorant child. He really doesn't understand. He wasn't very educated in anything about, like, culture.
It's a running gag through pretty much the whole series that Goku's just ha ha ha, he's kind of dumb. Sort of the whole country versus town motif is sort of Akira Toriyama's sort of own struggle. He's very much a country boy, and a lot of his manga they're kind of infamous for using this this rural slang. Usually in manga, and maybe in the Japanese language in general, but I know it's part of the vernacular of manga, that they will use the word baka. Right? I'm sure you've heard the word baka even.
You've mentioned it before, and we've,
I cannot be the only person that has told you baka, but if
you are,
if I am, I'm shocked, but there we go. The sort of hick version of that is Aho. He was like this country boy that wanted to be an artist, and he moved to the big city, and that this is sort of his experience, you know, sort of coloring that, you know. This is why Goku is like he's like this hick, this country boy, and he becomes the hero of the story because, you know, Toriyama's the hick. He's the country boy, and he's the hero of his own story, and it's his story. So that's really just where it comes from. And I think that I don't know if you were saying if it was like, was there any sort of deeper meaning? Is there any sort of criticism? Like, I'm not sure sort of what your angle was. Was just, you noticed that it was there, but I think that really that's where it's coming from.
It wasn't certainly criticism. It's interesting to me.
I was curious, like, if you were saying, like, this is a criticism of this, or like, why is it so disparate? I'm just kind of trying to see what angle you're coming at it from.
That certainly informs why he made those choices. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, if you want to, that only makes the kind of the world more interesting when you have different locations that can be multiple things. They can be, a simple, very rural, society, or it can be super advanced. And that just, it just paints a much kind of more colorful picture of the world, the world building, so to speak.
Yeah. I think a lot of these choices, a lot of them are just like, hi, I like to draw this stuff. I like to draw motorcycles and these little machines and airplanes and guns and all of this stuff. So he draws all the technology. And one of the things that I don't know this for a fact, but I kind of wanted to bring it up to you because I think it's weird and interesting, but there was like a cultural thing, I want to say, in like the early 80s, right around the time period when this came out, which I think is what launched the whole series.
Mm-hmm.
Is there was like a weird, like, I don't know what you'd call it, but it was like very trendy or very popular in Japanese culture. At least it was certainly in manga at the time, Chinese themes, Chinese visuals. And this is based off of a Chinese fairy tale. Do you know, there were a couple of pages about this in what we read. Do you know anything about the Sayuki story?
Yeah, well, I think we've briefly talked about it off air about it. You were looking at that one book I had,
yes.
Tales of the Monkey King.
That is also, it's based on the same character.
Yeah.
The character's name is Son Goku. I don't know if he's the hero of the story or not, but he's, the Monkey King. He's this incredibly powerful fighter that, he gets into all kinds of insane trouble. And he, like, I don't know, he tries to fight his way into heaven and Buddha beats the shit out of him. It's a strange world, and it's, very steeped in the sort of Asian mythology in the same way that Dragon Ball is. It's got its own sort of language of like ghosts and monsters and demons and, its own afterlife. And it's all very steeped in the same sort of ideas. I think to me, it's fascinating on that level alone.
I think that like a lot of comic books, it just takes an archetype and kind of starts telling a story with it, and then it goes in its own, its own direction.
Yeah, yeah, that it does.
There is one thing we're going to have to talk about, because it's the thing that stood out to me most, I think. And you might know where I'm going with this, but and you may be able to fill in on the background a little bit. I don't know.
Sure.
The sexualization of Bulma. And I know, I understand, like she's 16 and that.
Yes.
A little too young. I know it's 16, trying to be innocent. It's trying to be like kind of a naive thing, but.
It is and it isn't. 16-year-old girls in Japan, even today, girls can get married as young as 16. So it's just a different sort of, it's a different cultural norm. It is a very male-centric society, and they do sexualize young women. There are a lot of things about the way Bulma's done that made me pretty uncomfortable reading this book. She's not really a really great character, but you can't. They're a different society, and I think that their position is going to sort of have to evolve. Like, she's just sort of the hot girl that's angry all the time. You even see it, I think, carried through in One Piece that, like, I don't know. I sort of don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of jokes that they were using, like, oh, you know, Goku's completely, he doesn't know anything about sex or sexuality. Mm-hmm. And they're, I know that, that is, I understand that to a certain point, like, he doesn't understand. And, but then the fact, you know, the old master is, like, a pervert, like, I get it. Like, after the 10th joke of him, like, like, him being, like, this old pervert that, you know, never has sex and is obsessed with it, I'm just kind of like, okay, I got it.
I mean, that's just sort of is what his character is. I know. It's,
but it gets
it's
old.
Well, it's a trope, not even necessarily in Japanese comics, but possibly even in Japanese society, all Japanese media. You'll see these sort of similar ideas again, which is why I got really into I got really into manga in the 90s because I was really sick of the way how stupid American comics were in the 90s.
Yes.
And I had not been exposed to any of these tropes.
Right.
You know, it was all new territory to me. And that's why in the early 2000s, early mid-2000s, I got really fucking sick of anime because I started seeing the same things over and over. And I'm like, this isn't really funny anymore.
Right.
And it's the same gag over and over. This was done years ago. And it really, when you look at the history of things, that the decline of American comics sort of coincided with a golden age in Japanese animation. So it sort of worked out, you know, sort of favorably for all that. All this stuff got imported, but it's still, looking back, it is still very trope ridden, and it's making me, it's harder for me to enjoy things.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed the second, the volumes 4, 5, and 6, or I think after they found all the Dragon Balls for the first time, mm-hmm. and they all went their separate ways, I think I enjoyed from then on more than from that point up to that point, basically. I think because it was newer, I don't know. You get to see all these characters go their own, do their own thing. And I think it's weird that, like, the book is Dragon Ball and I enjoyed most of what doesn't involve the Dragon Balls.
Well, that is the majority of the story, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, it's not always about collecting Dragon Balls. They're just sort of, they're so far in the background. I mean, basically they just use it every so often way later in the story. Like, oh, one of their friends is dead. We'll wish him back to life. Whatever. they just sort of assume, like, we're just gonna, you know, they're Dragon Balls. They're there. It's not really that important a plot point from then on. It's really just, you know, the hook that gets you in the beginning.
Yeah,
I get that. I mean, that's when the sort of character work really begins. Like, it's all set up in all exposition up to all through 1 through 3. And I think that's kind of what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, I don't know. It's when they get to the fighting tournament and they're training. They go to the fighting tournament, and then he's, you know, Goku's off by himself trying to find the Dragon Balls. Like, I really enjoyed the tournament itself. Like, the art is gorgeous, and the fight scenes are really dynamic, and that was really what I was more expecting, you know, just from my very limited experience with the franchise, is that, you know, it's a lot of fighting and very, like, crazy dynamic weird fight scenes where, like, they're about to get knocked out of the like little ring or whatever you want to call it, and
yeah,
you know, the master blasts himself back on, or the Goku floats himself back over with his tail. You know, there's all these different weird, like, characters he brings in for, like, this little miniature Mortal Kombat tournament. And then I really did like him fighting. Like, I think that it's interesting, like, the pattern is Goku, like, fights some dude thinks he's much more stronger than Goku is. And then Goku just, like, wipes the floor with him and is completely kind of an innocent in almost every regard. Like, he thinks, oh, hey, like, if he gets beaten in combat, hey, you want to fight again later after I get better? Like, that I think is the thing that in the end makes me like it. I think because Goku is at his heart, like he's just a like a simple kid, and he's in a true innocent, I think. And like the fact that he can ride on that cloud, with the, I forget the cloud's name.
It's called I always say Kintoon. I don't actually know the correct pronunciation, but I say Kintoon.
But I think that despite, you know, there's that the icky kind of sexualization things of a 16-year-old girl, that at the heart it's following this like this true innocent along, that he's the protagonist, and that he's like at his core a good kid, like he doesn't want bad things to happen, you know. I think that what makes me like it at the end of the day.
I think that this is something that comes up a lot with you that I think is pretty interesting. It's you're very drawn to the Boy Scouts. You know, you really like the characters with the strong moral compass, or at least the characters that are innately good. Because I don't know that Goku sort of doesn't have a strong moral compass, at least at this point. He's just pure as the driven snow, because he's such a bumpkin.
I've never really thought about it.
Well, I'm sure you hadn't, but it's just, I just think it's interesting that the things that you're saying about Goku are the same things that you say about Steve Rogers and Superman.
Yeah. They're similar characters. I mean, they're like, what is it, Waffle Good? You want that alignment?
Yeah. I don't know if
lawful is the right word, because
yeah, I don't know if
they break the law if it's
exactly.
I think they're above, like they are for good first, and then
mm-hmm.
probably good. Just
Goku
good.
Is he kind of would alternate, I think, back and forth between lawful and chaotic good.
Right.
He's not exactly like a.
They don't want to hurt people. I think that's
yeah, exactly.
I think that's it. And I think I'm drawn to that. If I put any reason on it, it's just because that kind of character is difficult to write well. And I think that's another pro for this book, is that you root for Goku, even though he is like a bumpkin. Like like a lot of good characters, people call them boring.
Yeah.
I don't see that at all. Like a well-written Superman story or Captain America story or this, or Bone is another example. Bone is at his core a you know, he doesn't want to hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to make it compelling and interesting with this person as kind of the main character is difficult. And I can respect stories that make that choice. Like I would, you know, it's not that I don't like anti-heroes or anything like that. Like I love Wolverine and the Punisher and, you know, Batman and so forth, but they're, I don't know. You see bad stories more often tied to them just because people just,
yeah, they're hung up on the badassness of things. I think,
like,
you know,
they're
hung up on they're the people that listen to Citizen Soldier.
Yeah. There's a reason I loved Frankencastle so much.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, Frankencastle is kind of this monster, but he's still helping people. He's still, mm-hmm. he does this because he doesn't want people to be hurt like he was. And I think that's like, even in Wolverine the same, like when they're showing these kind of anti-heroes as vulnerable, I think that's the most interesting version of those characters. And it's when you're this kind of this inherently good character, it makes me want to read about it. Like, I think if there's a trend in this podcast about what we like in comic books a lot of the time, like Miss Marvel, we talked about it this week. She's kind of just like a good kid. I do also want to talk about kind of the, I'm sure there's a lot of things that are like the explicit references in this to like pop culture, which I'm sure many of them went over my head because I'm not very familiar with a lot of things, but I mean, they even asterisk some of this stuff and say, this is a reference to this. Like he makes a reference to Dr. Slump, sold it. Why I liked reading it and having it, you know, it's an adventure comic. And I think the most important thing about adventure comics is that they just push the fun. Like here's some fun things. And it's generally a light. And of course his art is really, really good and really gorgeous. Yeah.
And it's fun too.
Yeah.
That makes it work on that level.
Yeah, it does. And I think another thing I like about the second set, the 4, 5, and 6 more than 1, 2, 3 is the fact that that, I don't know, Bulma becomes more of an actual character. Like,
yes.
They show her as she's the daughter of this famous inventor, the guy who's invented these little capsule things. And, that she's actually a genius because she can work on this stuff like not many other people can. And, they widen the focus a little bit, I think, and that's generally he's created this interesting world. I think I don't know, maybe I just don't like the old master very much.
I think that's so weird because I really love Mutant Roshi. I think he's great. I love him in this book, and I think he makes me laugh. Like I guess I'm a sucker. I fall for the same joke every time. He just I think it's I love the way he's drawn. I think he's just. I don't know. He's a clown. He's so funny. And when he's serious, I think that works really well too. I don't know. I'm a Mutant Roshi fan.
The fact that I like him. I mean, when he's just being like, I really like him during the fighting tournament when he's just being like this goofy character who's trying to be like, hey, I'm not really me. I'm this other dude, Jackie Chun.
Yeah.
Which that's the dumbest pun name, but
that's what Toriyama's known for is dumb puns. That's he's Oda's biggest influence, right? Ichiro Oda from One Piece. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. But I like that. I guess I don't like that perverted old man trope, like overriding everything else about the character. That I think that's my bone of contention. With him is that like you see a little bit of that in the later ones we read, but it's not like the only thing about him. He's like this goofy old man, and like he wants to help help his students by beating the crap out of them. I really like those fight scenes, and they're very creative how they how he tells the story in those, like it'd be easy for those fight scenes to be boring and stuff, like, just show panel after panel of them punching and stuff. But he's very creative in making every new succession of like, what's going to happen next? Like it's very effective in telling a story. And that's saying something, because a lot of times in superhero comics, when you get like long fight scenes that just go on forever and ever, they just are like people trading punches and it's kind of boring. And it makes it, first of all, not like, it tones down, like it's, you would think like with these people are the most powerful martial artists in the world, like it doesn't emphasize the violence as much as like the creativity and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another thing that makes it really interesting to me.
I think one of the best illustrations of this point is it's in book four, I want to say, where Jackie Chun and Krillin. But Jackie Chun and Krillin are sort of reenacting a little interaction that they had in about a second.
And no one could catch it because it was so fast.
Yeah, it was so fast. And I think it's a perfect example of exactly what you're saying is applying some creativity to make what would otherwise just be a lot of dumb punching. To add some flavor to it, but it's just pure Toriyama stupidity, and that it makes it a lot of fun. I mean, like he tries to punch Jackie Chun in the face and he spits on his hand and he's like, ugh. And then he tries to counter punch and Krillin shoots boogers at him.
Yeah. I think it's really funny because that is playing with like the sports commentator presence there. Mm-hmm. Like it's an instant replay without instant replay.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of fun. And like that, both those guys, they're in the middle of a big fight and yet they pause to show everyone. Yeah. This is what happened in that half a second. At this moment I paused and that took maybe 0.2 seconds to think about what I was going to do next. And like, it's playing within like the tropey genre, which I think is where this book really excels, is, not necessarily I had a conception about how all these fight scenes would go, and he played against it by making it less serious, not more serious.
Well, I think that all the tropes and the things that you're thinking of, they're from much later in the series.
Yes.
This is Toriyama when Toriyama was having fun. You know, he was right. really enjoying what he was doing. And it wasn't, it's, I was actually shocked. The scene with, when he fights, when Goku fights Jackie Chun, that is the most Dragon Ball Z moment.
Yeah.
In these books, in all six of them. When Jackie Chun, when they're shooting energy beams at each other and he shoots lightning at him, and it's the most, like you, it is the proto Dragon Ball Z fight in these books. And it is also, I had no idea, but in the Dragon Ball universe, the moon has been blown up twice. This being the first time, then they restore it with the Dragon Balls, and then later Piccolo blows it up himself when Gohan is transforming.
You wanted to ask me about the names?
There are a lot of things in Dragon Ball that are contested with the names. Like, people spell, like, even in these very books on the cover, they spell Son Goku differently. They spell it G-O-K-U. On the cover of one, they spell it G-U-K-U-H. I think specifically, there's a lot of contention. There's a lot of different spellings for names. There's been a lot of different translations, and a lot of these also carry with them their own versions of those names. Like Tien and Tenshinhan are the same person. And that there are versions where those are used interchangeably. This Viz manga sort of uses a lot of different names interchangeably. I just wanted to sort of know, like, what of that you picked up on? What names you struggled with? Like, what didn't make a lot of sense?
It actually wasn't that bad for me. I don't know which... I bought those 3-in-1s because I could not find it online digitally. So I just bought those 3-in-1s you had pointed out.
You couldn't find it online digitally. I got it straight off of Comixology.
Really? I searched for Comixology. I could not find it.
I'm looking at it right now. Comixology. It's great.
I searched Dragon Ball and I could not. On the site now. Maybe I typed it. Is it one word?
I searched for Dragon Blall and I got it. So what? I didn't even put in the right search.
It's two words. I'm an idiot. That's the problem.
Well, it should come up regardless.
It did not. I searched Dragon Ball one word because that's what I thought it was.
Well, yeah.
And
it's written that way everywhere, but it doesn't. It should have come up either way. I think that's a real failure on their part.
But it's cheaper. It was cheaper to get it actually on the Amazon. But
I don't doubt that. I mean, but it's not like
$12 for 3 volumes. So
that's, holy shit, that's a lot cheaper.
Yeah. So 12. To be honest, 25 bucks.
To be honest, though, I have this split. I have one of the 3-in-1s, one of the older ones, and I have the Viz scans on my Comixology app. And honestly, God, it's a lot more pleasant to read. I greatly prefer reading it on my iPad.
Right.
It's unwieldy to read this big stupid book.
Yeah. We're back to the names. I really didn't have that much of an issue. There really isn't that many characters. And these I don't know if it's in those digital editions, but they have a cast of characters at the very beginning. Like, even if you don't know who they are, you can refer back to this page and it will tell you. But it also helps that he makes his designs, you know, very unique. None of these characters look super similar. Maybe Kuririn? I don't know if I'm saying that
well,
right.
Well, that's the thing. That it's Krillin.
That's Krillin? Okay.
Well, that's the whole thing about a lot of these names, is you can pronounce it a lot of different ways. Like, Bulma's name, when you think about the Japanese phonetics, it's Buruma. Which is why they laugh at her and like, your name means bloomers.
Right.
No, they're actually saying bloomers.
Right.
But it just, you know, when you write it out in phonetic Japanese, it's Bulma.
Right.
It's that this whole, they don't really have a letter that, they don't really have an R or an L. They right. have a letter that's sort of both.
Right. That's
And they're yeah. used interchangeably, which is why, you know, you'll get a lot of embarrassing things later in the anime, like Piccolo's called Picaro, you know, in some times, and it's the kind of thing that a lot of people like to make fun of, but it's just that it's just the way the language is.
I think that's when I was never confused reading the manga. Mm-hmm. I knew all the characters. I don't know how to pronounce half of them anyway, half the names anyway.
Well, you could, there's kind of no wrong way. Like, you could say Curren, but a lot of, like, it's been simplified to Krillin.
Right.
Because those R's might as well be L's.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the same, it's got the same root as the, like what they call Goombas in Japanese Mario.
Mm-hmm.
It's Kuribo-san. I think it's got the same root. I think it means chestnut. I'm not sure, but I think that's what his name means. I think that's what it's from. Almost all of the non-Sayuki story names in Dragon Ball, they're food puns. Except for everyone in Bulma's family, which they're all named after underwear. Bulma is named after bloomers. Her father is Dr. Briefs. She has a son named Trunks.
Okay.
Trunks Briefs.
Trunks Briefs. That's a good name.
That's his name.
I'm going to name my son that. Trunks Briefs Storman.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good name.
That's a strong name. He'll come from the future and cut a cyborg in half.
Anything else you want to touch on about this, Eric?
Why don't you just sort of give me a synopsis of the things that sort of surprised you the most?
Surprised me the most, how little of it is like the anime, from my limited experience.
Even the stuff that
is the
fuel of that stuff that you're thinking of, even it is considerably better than that.
Yeah, I would expect that. Most
people called it drag on ball for a good reason.
I think it's different from what the preconception of what, you know, the anime is, and the fun adventure, the con we talked about, you know, the sexualization of Bulma.
That to me is still a cultural thing, even though this is.
I tried not to like hold it against it, and
you kind of have to. I mean, there's things that you're not experiencing in this. Like, all of the black people in this are drawn like blackface, and it's censored in these editions that you and I have. Like, he draws great big blackface lips on all the black people, and they're like, it's painted over to where it looks like their mouth is open or something. And it looks really strange if you know what it is, but I feel like it's actually probably a little bit transparent. Or did it look wrong to you?
I've known about the kind of, I think we had the discussion when we read Mad Woman of the Sacred Heart, mm-hmm. which also had suffered from some of that kind of racism. And it's another thing where I'm like, this is very troubling, but I'm going to keep reading and see. You know,
you kind of have to look the other way because it's just sort of based in ignorance. I mean, you have to understand Japan is like a little walled off garden where there are literally no ethnic groups but Japanese people. Like, I would go over there, they would think I was Hulk Hogan.
Right.
Like, they can't.
You're not Hulk Hogan?
I not even on Sundays. But no, like they cannot tell non-Japanese people apart. They don't even like Koreans. Like they're very racist. They don't understand anything but Japanese people. It just sort of is their culture. They're just not exposed. So like, you know, they put a black person in a comic. It's like the weirdest thing they've ever seen.
Yeah, I don't. There's that stuff that I just kind of have to go. It's around, and I talk about it.
Yeah,
and say, you know, these are certainly troubling things about the story. We have to, you know, hopefully it'll change.
It was during the 80s,
right?
And it was in a culture that they have no idea. So it's like Will Eisner.
Right.
What was the Spirit's compatriot? What was his name?
I forget. I cannot think of it.
That's a terrible name. It was probably something terrible like Bobo or something awful.
Right.
And racist. But I mean, Will Eisner's not a racist. You know, when he was older, well, you know, when he was still alive, I should say, not when he was older,
he came out of the womb, he was 63 years old.
Yeah. In his later years, during more, you know, more modern times, he said, you know, I kind of regret drawing him the stereotypical way, but it was the 40s or when the hell was it? Was it the 40s? 50s?
Yeah.
50s. I mean, we're talking long damn time ago. It's like, it just sort of was the culture. He was very much a product of the time. You can't really fault him for it. I mean, all these newfangled ideas about treating people with respect are very, very, very new ideas.
Right.
And Toriyama, to his credit, has actually redrawn some panels to make them less racist.
Right.
Because he admits, like, you know, I didn't know. I didn't know it was a bad thing. So I don't think it's really fair to shame him too much on it. I mean, there's definitely a lot of things in this that look strange to a foreign eye, but it's a tough thing to sort of look at someone else's culture and be too judgmental about it.
Yeah. And that's, I think, all the troubling things about it. You know, when I just kind of, you just have to look at it through that lens. Cause
yes.
Because there is a lot of really, I mean, the art, his art is I experienced with Bone and Life and Times of Scrooge. The art is really beautiful, really dense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we were talked about the density of the storytelling and all that earlier. Even when there's not a lot of text, the art is very engaging and dynamic and gorgeous.
It's some of my favorite all-time artwork. I mean, I grew up idolizing this man. I mean, I could just sit and stare at his artwork forever, and I'm actually reading some of this stuff for the first time. I don't know. It kind of blows my mind to think that these iconic images that I've sort of grown up with, that a human person did them.
Right.
You know, it's stunning. It's shocking.
Yeah,
it's glorious.
We should revisit the next few books another time, and eventually, you know, we can work our way through the saga.
Wow. Wow, I can't believe it's had that much of an impact on you.
Well, I would like to see. I mean, I think it's inherently interesting.
Good.
It's like The Walking Dead. I think it's something that goes on that long and is such obviously a cultural touchstone.
Mm. And the thing is about Dragon Ball is it not just in Japan. We're talking world fucking wide.
Yeah.
This is one of the biggest comics that has ever, ever happened.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's another reason I think it inherently provokes discussion. That just the fact that it is so well known and that there's so much media based around it, and honestly, it's a lot of fun to read. So I think that, you know, we could come back, and I don't want to do what we did with Walking Dead because I think
I think we need a reprieve.
Yeah,
although this is not so many like people getting their eye sockets crushed.
That's very true, dear Lord. But eventually we can, you know, work all the way up to for everything in Dragon Ball, and I mean we can hit Dragon Ball Z too eventually. We can, and I just the inherent movement of the series and all that, it provokes you know, interesting discussion
that fills my heart with song.
So I think that'll be it. Next week, folks, we are gonna be at DragonCon, Southeast's largest comic and pop culture convention. I think they call them that. I don't know what you want
to. I think it's ridiculous to say that it's a comic convention.
It is, but there's
all those media people can fucking go to hell.
Yeah, but so, you know, if you're gonna be in town, you know, let us know. Well, you can, if you see a luchador Batman wandering around, that'll be me. You see El Batman, you know, El hanging Batman around somewhere, that's me.
You didn't, you didn't put together Tracksuit Dracula, huh?
No, I'm lazy. Frankly, with a wedding coming up and our living situation uncertain, money is kind of
you don't important. Want to. You don't want to. You're not going to cosplay to your own wedding.
No, I'm going to cosplay as a handsome groom. I will be Luchador Batman with Luchador Robin, Luchador Green Lantern, and Luchador Wonder Woman.
Uh oh, man, we're really bringing the crowd this time, and you're and a guy in a suit,
and a guy with a cowboy hat
and a suit
and a suit. That'll be Eric. You guys, you see some dude look dressed real nice with a cowboy hat on, or a newsy cap. It could be a newsy cap. He wears those from time to time,
or a schoolboy cap, which is what I call it because I'm a fucking idiot.
Either way, I don't even know what the name is,
but it's a newsboy cap. It's okay. Fine,
but that'll be Eric. He's the loudest person you'll hear. If you're walking around Dragon Con and there's someone who's the loudest person you've ever heard, it's Eric. He'll be yelling at one of our comic creators about how great he likes their art.
To be fair, I'm not really that loud. I'm just always yelling in your ear.
If you're very close to him, he's very loud. I'm like Roger Daltrey. Just, you know, I'm in the Who, so I have to deal with the noise. Okay, we're ridiculous.
This is the most fun I've ever had.
We're gonna be in. So yeah, we're both very excited about that. We'll have a full on report for you in the next episode. It will be a lot about us having fun. I think that's.
I'm looking forward to a little bit of fun.
Yeah. So I think that will bring us to a close for this week. We are the Handsome Voice Comics Hour. You can find us at handsomevoicecomicshour.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/handsomevoicecomicshour. You can find us on iTunes. Please review and subscribe to us. Those things really help us get more listeners, get us more better placement in the iTunes infrastructure. I really don't know how it works, but I know it helps.
It's magic.
Apparently it is. We're on Twitter at HBCHour. You can tweet at us there. Find us lots of places online. Google. We're everywhere.
We're in the Google.
We're in the Google. You can find me online on Twitter at MixmasterCereal. That's MixmasterCereal. Eric, where can they find you online?
You can... my goodness. You can find my portfolio by going to freewillunlimited.com. You can see most of the things I get up to online by going to ericzgoodnight.com. And you can tweet at me. My Twitter handle is Mr. Bad Example, spelled M-R Bad Example.
And with that, folks, we will be talking at you next week. Have a good one.
Rock and roll.